Hey, welcome to Stew for Thought, a student podcast project made possible through a special partnership with KBOO Radio and presented by the Native American Student and Community Center here at PSU. In each podcast, we'll discuss various things revolving around Indigenous people and their way of life, both modern and traditional. Hi, my name is Raven. Welcome to Stew for Thought. I'm currently a part of the Native American Student Community Center's marketing team. I am Athabaskan and Yupik and currently enrolled in Eastern Shoshone. And today we have Sherrod.
Hello.
Okay, so to start off, what is your origin story?
My origin story, like my superhero?
Yes, Marvel. Exactly.
I'm more of a dark horse, I think, origin story. So my name is Sherrod Yonker. I grew up in a small town on the southern Oregon coast in Coos Bay, Oregon, particularly on South Slough, which is where my dad grew up as well, and probably about at least 10,000 years, his family through his mother's side as well. So I am enrolled with the Coquel Indian tribe. I'm also Millik Coos and Umpqua. My other, ethnicities also happen to be German and, English and Filipino, amongst other things. But that's where I grew up. That's where my tribe is located, where tribes are located. And that's, is my origin story in a nutshell.
Awesome. Okay, so how did you start creating art?
I think I've always, when I say always, probably at a very young age, just started picking up drawing and making art as a way to entertain myself. We had a TV, but we only had 1.5 channels, right?
Oh.
The half channel was a snowy channel. So not a lot of toys growing up, a lot of outdoor activities, a lot of books, just looking at things and learning how to draw or just entertaining myself. My mother wasn't an entertainer for us kids. So it was, she'd either kick us out of the house, or if we weren't bothering her, we could do whatever in the house if we didn't make a mess. So that happened to be reading a lot and or drawing, just drawing. So that's really how I got into art, so to speak.
Cool. How has art changed your outlook on life in general?
I think it helps me understand who I am a little bit more. And I think it's just a way that I process things that I can't really talk about. Or if I can talk about them, I don't think it comes off as well as it does through art. Not saying that my art explains everything that I wanted to say, but in my mind it does. Maybe not so much to everybody else, but to me, I'm usually making art that explains things to me, or they're just funny in terms of the dichotomy of different things.
Do you see yourself as an artist or a revivalist, or both?
I like the word revivalist because I have, growing up in a religious household, that's a little bit different. So, but I think both art, it really is determined by how people describe my art. So I think, when I say my art, I mean me attempting to make art that's within the aesthetic sensibilities of my ancestors, right? A revivalist in the sense of trying to replicate traditional art forms, I think, I don't know if it necessarily, if I'm trying to revive something as much as I'm trying to understand it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand what my ancestors did to make this particular thing. So I'm not really trying to revive anything. I'm just trying to understand what's important to them. And then hopefully that will let me add that into my daily life. Now, if I get up and I start preaching about it, which I think happens a lot with a lot of us who make traditional arts, then you can call me a revivalist and somebody should come by and smack me in the back of the head or something, right? But what was the first part of the question? All I really heard was revivalist.
Oh, I said, do you see yourself as an artist or a revivalist?
Yeah. I think I view myself as an artist because I don't like to, I guess, compartmentalize as what I do as traditional art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's what I do make that. But I think that, in a sense, those things can be applied to everything else. I think the concepts that you get from making traditional art are much more than the actual piece itself, right? So it gives you just a better way of understanding kind of this world that we live in, right? You know, I mean, everything that's going wrong with the world now, I think the antidote to that is our traditional lifestyle. And I'm not saying we go back to living in longhouses and whatnot. But I think the way that our society works, or us at least trying to achieve that, will help us counteract, I guess, what I like to call the zombie apocalypse, right? Which is greed.
Yeah.
And the way our society works is we're thinking about being better people and taking care of other people because we know that that comes back to us, right? That's a complete opposite of that. But how do we get to that point, right? We're not going to go back to living in the longhouses in communal mm-hmm. situations, although we do live in communities. But how do we get to that point where we're thinking about the whole, right? The entirety of our society. And I think through the replication of our traditional art forms, not so we can have the object, but we can have the lesson, gets us to that point. It helps teach, for most of us, it will help teach us that. So I think a lot of people look as art as a, they see the thing hanging on the wall or the thing, and there's a lot of money to be made in that. But that's not, at least when I make art, that's not where I'm trying to go with this. I'm trying to understand why I make this and then why it's important and what that lesson, how I can apply it to something else. So I think that's a way that all of us can do that. And I think that's important for every indigenous person to make that, as long as they know that that process is the most important thing.
Yeah.
The object itself, maybe not so much, but the lesson, that's the true teachings of our ancestors, the lesson through making that, because a lot of us don't have elders that we can speak to anymore because they're older and just because they pass on doesn't mean that we stop learning because we don't have them around. We have to figure out how to keep doing that. And I think if we can even teach our non-native friends the importance of making, then we can change the way that they think. We can change them from being zombies,
yeah,
right, to thinking like Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want them to replace us, but they're here and they're not going away. That ship done sailed 500 plus years ago and they did not get on it, right? And just shy of us making another ship for them to put on, you know, which they're working on that themselves. They're all ready to go to Mars, right? When they somehow would be easier to live on a new planet than to take care of the one that already sustains them, right? So anyway, I guess I am a revivalist. I'll put away my little soapbox. Unfortunately, I'm the only revivalist on the corner, you know, preaching to the masses, right? All right. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's perfect. So kind of on a side note, I guess. So you kind of say it's more about lessons and, like, the actual traditions. But is there any specific mediums that you kind of gravitate towards, where like you, I guess, see more traditional value like within certain objects beforehand, like wood or stuff like that?
I think for me, it's the ones that I struggle the most with. I think as most of us, we you know, when you don't have a lot of money, you learn how to draw, right? Mm-hmm. And then somewhere somebody gives you a little bit of encouragement so you can continue to do that. And then you get to where you think you're good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to school, and then you find other people that are like that, and then you kind of get pushed by them as well. And then, at least for me, I got proficient enough that I wanted to move to something else. And so I gravitated towards printmaking, which is a little more process orientated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I also moved towards bronze casting, and really process orientated, but a much, much longer. So you'd spend an entire term or year working on one piece, and then you'd hold your fingers and hope that they would not, you know, they would not bust through the mold while you're pouring it. And then you come to the realizations that it's really expensive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of tone down what you're trying to do. But once again, it ended up being process. I liked the process. And so I went back to printmaking and really got into woodcut. And I really liked the process of running a sharp tool through wood. And then I started trying to take those printmaking tools and I started carving with those.
Oh, cool.
So I gravitated towards, you know, once you're out of college, you don't have everything that you need. So I started trying to go towards things that I could, that I still needed the process, right, to do whatever. At that point, I didn't really understand why I gravitated towards process things. But once I started getting into carving or learning more about carving, the struggle, I think, continues to keep me here because I don't consider myself a master carver. And so I really like struggling, trying to figure out how to make what's in my head in the wood, even though what I do is fairly simple. I consider it fairly simple in comparison to a lot of my peers. I have a great appreciation for what they do and like to see what they're doing to see if I can get to that point in skill level as well. So that's why I kind of stick with wood. And I suppose if I ever get to a point where I can do anything that I want with it, I'll probably find something else that I struggle with, right? So I struggle with the thing that I work in.
Yeah.
So,
what's the hardest medium that you've had to, I don't want to say deal with, but kind of mess around with, explore, I guess?
The hardest medium?
Yeah. Or even just like a thought process that just, you didn't know why it took so long for you to come up with an idea or.
I don't know if I have one particular thing that is harder than the rest. Because it doesn't matter whatever I take on, I seem to find things about it that I get hung up on.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think that there isn't a medium that I don't find something about what I'm doing that I don't struggle with or that I don't hate. There's always a project always gets to a point where I want to destroy it because I'm struggling trying to make it the way that I want to make it. And I think wood is really challenging in the sense that at least for me, it's finding wood that you can work with, that you can get out. So a lot of the really good carvers use really perfect old growth wood. And that can be either very expensive or you have access to that, which I don't. I live here in the city. So I use what I can have, I get access to. So the stuff that I do is different than what they do, despite our tribal aesthetics sensibilities. But printmaking is very difficult as well, and I think I struggle with that quite a bit. Painting, I really struggle with painting. And I think for me, it's because I think I have at least I believe I have an eye for what's good and what is not. And my paintings are not good. So that's a struggle for me. They're just not up to the of what I would like it to be. So I really stay away from that. That and the fumes. I can't handle the fumes. And I used to struggle in college with that. I used to pass out in the middle of my classes.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, I took it during the spring and it would get warm you know, you'd wake up half an hour later and you're sleeping on your, you know, on your painting, right? I'm like, okay, yeah, maybe this is not for me. I also struggle with ceramics. And you think that would be easier for me as it's an additive process, whereas carving is a reductive process. But for whatever reason, I don't like the way that clay dries my hands out. And so I have this kind of OCD thing going, I just don't like it. And so I wash my hands every couple of minutes. I'm back there washing my hands. So I end up washing my hands like 1,000 times trying to make anything out of clay. Right. And I'm like, God, what the hell? And it's like, okay. So I've given up on clay. But I like the idea of clay. I really like that idea. Maybe someday I'll figure out how to get over that.
Wear gloves.
Yeah, okay. That's what everybody tells me. Wear gloves, right? Yeah, yeah. So, who knows? I'm weird.
Is there any like materials that you wish were more accessible that you'd want to work with more?
Materials are more accessible. I think that there's a big revival on glass, and they're very, despite all of this, all these opportunities to do glass around here, financially it's prohibitive for a lot of people, right? So if you're not up in Seattle and you have an opportunity, or Tacoma, where you have an opportunity to get to the point to work with any of these organizations that can offer you that, then it makes it really difficult, right? But down here, there's definitely quite a few glass blowing places, and that's not necessarily that's the more affordable way to go glass. But that's not necessarily what I want to go into. I just want to be able to. I have a few projects that I know that medium would do really well, or at least that path in my mind would suit particular projects. In terms of concept and material, replicating some of the concepts of those traditional forms, I think would really lend itself well. But glass casting is really expensive, and glass, the time consumption to melt down the glass and then cast it, plus buying the glass, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just as grabbing a bunch of bottles and melting it down, and you know, you have to get the correct color that you want, and so it's really expensive. And, you know, maybe someday I'll get there, right?
Yeah. Okay. What's one piece of art that you find most valuable, like a piece that you've done?
Well, for me, it's whatever I'm working on at the moment. But in terms of conceptually and community-wise, I think it's just been working on canoes, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't consider myself a canoe maker, you know, and I've worked on probably about five canoes. And only one of them I was the project manager for. The rest I did, well, two, three of them. But the other two were single occupancy canoes. They were little umiaks, and I was having an umiak and a kayak, and I had help building those. And then the large canoe, or the 30-foot canoe for my father, I was the PM for that. And I was working with my dad and my cousins trying to just make a family canoe. And that one, if you want to call that art, it's probably the one that has the most impact or has the most potential,
mm-hmm.
right, in terms of it having a life outside of it being finished, right? So a lot of times, you have stages of your art. It's like the life it was before you find it, right, the material. And so it inherently has life. A lot of the stuff is wood, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was alive to begin with, so it has a spirit. And then your second stage is the process of after it's dead, right? After that material is dead, is you adding your life to it or your spirit to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's, for most people, it's done, right? When they finish it, they hang it up, right? They put it up somewhere. But they fail to recognize that something had to die for you to make your art form, right? Make your art to make something pretty. So it has a life. That third stage is its life afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where that piece ends up, you don't know. Or if it ends up being a wall hanger, for me, it just goes back to being dead, right? Unless it truly says something. And at least for a canoe, in our society, it has a life, and now it goes on to live, and other people get to add their spirit to it. So it's much more than me, my father, and my cousins adding our spirit to it. It then begins to fulfill its destiny, whatever that is. So even if I make a shitty canoe, right, and a lot of us do that, even if I make a shitty canoe and it's not to the aesthetic sensibilities or within millimeters of our ancestral dugout canoe, it still has this wonderful ability to add value to our family, to our tribe, and to get us to understand what's important to our ancestors, right? Because then it still goes back to what were our ancestors doing in their canoe. And then we're doing that as well. For a lot of us, when we're paddling or pulling, you at least open yourself up for that short amount of time to understand what that is, or at least open that door or that keyhole to peek through. And you can, hopefully you can see that for that short amount of time, right? You're going at maybe 6 miles an hour. So you understand what's important. Is this water important? Is this canoe important? Am I important? Or is what I'm doing important? Is this water that we're paddling through important? Are these animals that live here important? Are these? And then hopefully you can apply that, right? So I think for me, is probably why a canoe, or a canoe that I built with my family, is probably the most important thing that I've done. One, because it was a group project. It wasn't just me making it.
Yeah.
I definitely had to learn how to get along with my dad and my cousins, because they all had ideas of what they wanted to do. And I had to say, hey, no, we got to do this, this, and this. That may be a great idea, but to get this, we have to do this, right? So it definitely taught me patience. It definitely taught them patience, too, because they're much older, and they're not used to listening, doing whatever they want, right? And so I think learning how to work together was a good process for me. So I guess that is that, right? That's the best example I could give.
Did you do them for Grand Ron, the two canoes?
No.
I remember seeing the little pulley ones that someone did. that were single for like the kids?
No. That's Brian. Brian. Yeah. No. In fact, yeah. Brian is taken on working with John McCallum. So the first canoes that John built for Applegate Boatworks, his son had tried to do a project and through pictures made a macaw style canoe. The lines were off, everything was off. So he somehow started working with Tony. He made another one for Quinault called the Tabale, and it was also off, but it looked better. And then in that process, it was in the 90s, was looking and trying to find out what our tribe's canoes were, and was able to find out what they were. We didn't find examples, but found written archival material that said specifically what our canoes were. So John was working with Tony Johnson, trying to replicate those. And so I kind of led an effort for us to employ John to build a canoe. And he prototyped the first prototype for that West Coast Chinook style canoe with my tribe. And then subsequently it led to more canoes down the road, working with John McCallum and him fine tuning those. So then Grand Ron's canoe, Chinook's canoes, and then Grand Ron's canoes all came after that prototype that he had done with our first canoe. And then subsequently we had another one built by John and crew, and then he's gotten older, and then Brian has kind of stepped in and worked with him. And so now Brian makes the canoes. John comes over and looks at them. Brian makes them, and so he started a business doing that. So
they have a shop at my house.
One of those canoes that I worked on, it's not finished, is sitting in your garage.
Okay, that's what I thought.
That was a group project with a bunch of teenagers, and we just ran out of time.
Okay.
And we ran out of time to finish it, and then because it was a 2-week long camp. And not enough time. Plus, the kids were making their own knives and their own paddles and carving, and then also working to try to make a canoe. And so we got like half done.
Well, I saw it and I was like, "Ooh, a canoe!" So
yeah, and it lived underneath the studio for a good 10 years. So it's not the correct shape anymore. And so it's now living in your garage. Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I was happy coming back and seeing random canoes.
Yeah, like, but at in least our shop. It's hanging out with other canoes.
Yes, really the it's most happy. Thing, right? Yeah. Okay, so is there anything that keeps you from pursuing different mediums or artwork, like outside of accessibility, like financial reasons why, like the glasses you mentioned?
I think what really keeps me from doing anything is just myself and my own personality. And not being able to focus on one particular thing. So, my wife and I run our own business, and I think that this living here, specifically in terms of you have to figure out how you're going to pay for things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if we possibly lived in Warm Springs or in Coos Bay, our expenses would be a lot less, and then we could focus on one particular thing. So for me, in an ideal world, I could just focus on making art. I'm sure I'd still have a hard time doing that to motivate myself to do that every day. But the other projects that we do are equally as important, maybe even more important than what I do as an artist. Because art in general is a luxury, right? Because it's about the artist. The artist gets to find out what this art form is about, right? And whether they choose to share that or not is really... So it can be really a self-centered idea, even though what I'm dealing with and a lot of other Native artists are dealing with are more about the whole and describing that and understanding that what about our societies, it still can be pretty self-centered work if we don't focus on the end game of what that is, right? And truly what the end of what that is describing our world. It's understanding our world, understanding our relationship to it. And so that being said, the other work that I do with my wife is a lot of natural resource work. And so now that my art has led me to understanding my world a little bit more, it also makes me have to be more responsible. I'm trying to figure out how to take care of it and be a better steward. So I think my other work helps pay the bills, but it also gives me the satisfaction of knowing that hopefully the work that I'm doing is actually, you know, putting in the groundwork of having something happen. Whereas my art, possibly, if they ever get past the object and understand what it means, then they, oh, that's nice. He's telling us to take care of the environment. Although you can't see it in the piece because it's a paddle, right?
Yeah.
Right. But at least of this other form, it's like, okay, we're teaching youth or we're teaching adults all those little things about our environment and how we take care of that, even if it ends up being having to deal with energy issues, natural resource issues, man-made and natural infrastructure regarding water. So I think that may keep me from fully focusing on art, but at the same point, it's probably more important than my art, right?
Yeah.
But they are tied into each other.
Mm-hmm.
So. Simple question, big answer that's now all confusing, right?
No, it's the point. What motivates you?
Good question. That's the hardest one that I struggle with, is motivation. I think guilt is really what motivates me. And even then, that's hard to overcome, right? So it's like, oh. I think if I lived by myself in the woods somewhere, I don't know if I would have any motivation at all, right? Because I could just do what I need to do to keep myself fed, and there wouldn't be any pressure from anybody to do anything. But I think having a family and having people that I'm responsible to, even outside of my family, I think helps motivate me. And then also, I guess, at least trying to give the appearance of being a good human being, right? I don't know, I think everybody should have to be subject to that, right? But some people just don't care, obviously, they don't. Yeah, there you go. I guess that guilt and appearances, right? Just total, probably not the answer you were looking for, but probably the only one that's keeping me in line, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. How does your traditional values intertwine with your urban or 21st century idea or values?
Okay. How do my traditional, let's go over that question again.
Okay, so how does your traditional values intertwine with your urban or 21st century values/ideas?
Okay. So, traditional values, right? Okay, so I, at best, am still a country boy. You can't just grow up in Coos Bay and expect that shit to wash off you. Or get out of your bloodstream, right?
Mm.
But I have been living here in Portland longer than I've lived in Coos Bay. I'm at that age, right? But I don't know if I have urban values. So I think for any Indigenous person that lives in an urban setting, it's always about if they choose to identify as that, right? I think it really is about finding what is important to you or what's important to your your people, right? And then understanding how to apply that in whatever your application are, right? So you talking to me, which is the big mistake, right? I think at least the process of that and you talking with other people is trying to find out how, if there's anything of value that's coming out, right, that I or other people have gotten from their elders or their people and can share that will help us right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think as somebody who lives in an urban setting or may have grown up in an urban setting, even within our own tribal communities, even those are not in a traditional form at all, right?
Yeah.
Even now, I struggle with people that say decolonize, 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 and then they go back and it's like, yeah, on the res, on the res, on the res, and I'm like, what the hell are you guys talking about? It was like, the res is not some place that we should be looking at. Every nook and cranny, every little creek, every little thing here, with the exception of the Southwest, we'll just run it, should have people on it, should have indigenous people on it, right? So how do we get to that point? How do we, I think I heard something a couple weeks ago by an indigenous man from Duwamish, saying that we have thousands of years. Some people say 10,000. We know it's much longer than that. You know, there's a new village site in Lapway that's 16,000 years old, right? Or not in Lapway, but within Nez Perce country, that's 16,000 years old. There's other places that they believe to be, you know, 20 or 30. And then you found mastodon bones that have been worked on at 130,000 years ago in San Diego, right? So we know that our indigenous people have been here a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out how to round this back to where we were going. So we know that the bones of our ancestors are in this land. Thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and our DNA and our atoms are intermingling with every plant, every tree, everything on this ground. And what he was saying was like, my earth loves me better than it loves you. And he's not speaking to me as the but he's speaking to non-indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
They've only been here so long. Bones of their ancestors, their genetics are not within this environment. So our earth loves us more because we've had thousands and thousands of our ancestors living here. But it also makes us responsible to that, of wanting to keep this and to repair it and to save it, because it is us.
Mm-hmm.
It owns us. We keep saying, oh, this is, you know, this is our land. It's like, it's not our land. We belong to it, but we are also it, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter where you grow up if you lived in a rural area, you live in a reservation area, and where I grew up is exactly the same place that my ancestors grew up. There's really nothing different than one. But I still have an obligation to understand what that is that makes it special, makes me a part of it, and vice versa. So if you grow up here, understanding what those values are and trying to take care of it is equally as important as growing up wherever your people are, right? Or where their origin is. But taking care of this, the footprint that we have. I'm not saying I'm doing a good job of that, but I at least understand it And the guilt of that
motivates you.
Motivates me to try to be a little bit better human being, because, you know, because eventually I'm going to go under the ground, and, you know, hopefully my child or my grandchildren, if I have those, or at least my relatives, ancestors, will be thinking the same thing, and hopefully I can guilt them into. You know, at an atomic level, right? To take care of this place, right? There you go.
Okay, semi-serious question next. If you were a crayon, what color would you be?
I was a crayon, right?
And what would you name yourself?
Oh, my God. I don't know. If I was a crayon, jeez. That's a freaking hard one, right? Let's see. What color could I possibly think of? Okay. I would lose. Okay. Is there a hummingbird-like crayon who it changes colors? I know I'm more of a burnt umber, but I would like to be, I'm a burnt umber, but I identify as a hummingbird colored crayon. How's that? Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I like the option. And it's only because we don't have enough cones and rods in our eyeballs to see those colors. Right. Yeah. So I may look like a dull, you know, brownish crayon, but in reality, we just haven't evolved enough to see all the colors that I could be, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There you go.
Okay. Lastly, what are your current projects or, like, future opportunities?
Current project. Okay. I've got a lot, and my motivation has not been good about finishing it. So right now I've got a paddle in the car that I've got to get to Oregon Historical Society Museum. And I'm struggling with it. I've got a sculpture with a group of other people at PNCA who are doing similar things to try to reclaim a space within the new PNCA building with, I think, Greg Robinson and Greg Archuleta, Toma Villa, Lillian Pitt, and I think there may be two more. We're trying to reclaim that space. And so I've got a sculpture I've got to start for that. I've got a group sculpture with three other carvers that we're doing a public sculpture for Oregon State University's their new forestry building. What else? There's some stuff I'm working with 8th Gen. There's a blanket coming out fairly soon, and that was a collaborative piece with Tony Johnson and myself, and that'll be coming out, I think, maybe in May. Let's see. I know there's some other ones I'm missing here. And then another, it's not art, but there is two art projects working with groups to make canoe paddles. They may not be in particular thing that I'm making myself, but I do like to teach people how to make a canoe paddle so they can apply that, mm-hmm. right? They can use it. And then also a non-art form, but our second annual Tribal Youth Water Summit happening at the end of the summer at U of O. Same thing. Trying to get them to understand everything about water that we can, especially with all the kind of issues that we're going on, how to get them involved in knowing everything that we do as adults or leaders that have to work in natural resources. So by the time they get to that, when they become a leader, they can't be taken advantage of, right? Or they're just off and running, right? So that they're not being held back by the learning about things later. So that's what I've got going on now. Who knows if I'll finish all of them. But, Yeah, there you go.
For that last opportunity, what's like the age range?
We have the age range is like 15 to 19 for the youth.
Okay.
And then we do have some chaperone things for like college age people as well. So last year we had probably, let's say we had maybe 16 to 20 students. And so it's a residency where they live on campus. And then, they do class style lectures in the morning. And in the afternoon, we do field trips and applying those, right? And also we brought in some people to teach kind of basic filmmaking, right? But using your phone. Right. So because every high school kid's got a phone, you know, and so learning how to take A roll and B roll and going on field trips and then having them try to giving them the tools to have their own voice. Right.
Yeah.
My nickname at the end of that was they were just calling me A roll all the time. So I kept yelling, get B roll. Yeah. So, and then we had lecturers come in and elders come in and they would take a role on the elders and the experts, and then the field trips they would be getting a lot of B roll, right? And then using a free app on their phone, they would learn how to piece that together and make their own story, whatever that was, right? What concerns them, right?
Yeah, sounds really cool.
yeah. So August it'll be happening. Yeah. So yeah, just bug me. Bug me farther into July, right?
Yeah.
So if you're interested, because we do take a few college students, right? Okay.
Okay. So just to kind of conclude, do you have any last comments, statements, tangents?
I think I did an awful lot of tangents before. A warning. I think I warned you at the beginning. This is all of this information that I've given you, all my opinions. I reserve the right to change them from any time from this room, walking out of this room to the near future, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important for young people as well as other people to challenge whatever my thoughts and ideas are. So it gives me a better understanding of, I guess, maybe a better understanding of myself, a better understanding of everything else. Or it confirms what I believe in, and it makes me understand and be able to articulate a little bit more with, you know, having discourse with other people, right? Or having, conversations to do that. So there you go. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for listening, and thank you for coming.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate you thinking that I have anything important to say.
Well, you do.
Yeah.
We have about 50 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Of importance.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, tune in next time to Stew for Thought.
All right. That was a slow cooking stew.
I know.